Chapter 27. From Bletchley Blethering's, September 1941. Nothing here surprises us anymore. A gaggle of wrens singing madrigals by the lake, attacked by the meanest swans and bucks. Old hat. A group of naval section boys sunbathing nude on the side lawn, shrieking women fleeing at the sight of all that pasty skin. Yawn. General Montgomery spotted in the dining room at 3 a.m, poking at a plate of corned beef and prunes. Pass the salt, General. But frankly, B.B. fell over in a dead faint at the sight of our latest visitor. Mab was on break from the bomb machines, and a group of codebreakers were playing a makeshift game of rounders on the lawn and arguing.
Cantwell's not out. He got past the conifer. No, it was the deciduous.
Giles gave Mab a wave.
Come join, my queen. We need long legs on this team of waddlers.
The idea of stretching her legs sounded glorious. Hanging her new hat on the nearest tree branch, Mab rolled up her skirt and took a stick, which was all they had for bats. 10 minutes later, she bashed the ball a great whack and sprinted for the tree. Rounding one! Rounding two! But then she came to a halt, jaw nearly hitting the grass, because a cluster of dark-suited figures was advancing from the mansion like a small fleet, led by Commander Denniston, who was explaining something to a short, bulldog figure. A figure Mab recognized. Winston Churchill stumped past, close enough to reach out and touch, giving the rounders players a nod. Giles gaped.
Was that?
The PM wasn't at all as Mab had imagined him. Shorter, limping badly, hair wispy above his black pinstriped suit. No sign of his famous hat, his cigar. Mab had always imagined he would be full of noisy bravado and bluster, but he walked along quietly, looking about him with a measured gaze. Is he touring the place? She whispered. My God! She bolted for her hut, sliding past the ministerial party when they detoured for Hut 7. She was in place at her machine's side, skirt unrolled and hair combed, when the door opened and Churchill was ushered inside. The wrens came to attention and saluted. Mab saluted with them. She was a civilian, but it was the Prime Minister standing there on the oily floor, looking at the machine she hated so much.
Wren Stevens, Commander Denniston said. A demonstration, if you please.
Stevens stood frozen to the spot.
This machine is called Agnes Day, Prime Minister.
Mab spoke up when it was clear her partner couldn't summon a word. Crisply, she demonstrated, plugging up the back according to the menu, loading the drums, tweezing apart the fine wires. He fired questions, wanting to know everything. She answered as best she could. Wren Stevens eventually came forward and began responding too. The PM whistled, impressed by the sheer din when Aggie and her sister machines were set into motion. Waiting for a full stop might have taken hours, so Mab called a halt, explaining what it meant when a bomb machine went quiet. As Churchill thanked them, she felt an almost violent urge to nurture. He looked so tired, rings under his eyes, shoulders bowed. Wasn't anyone looking after him while he looked after the whole nation? She wanted to cook the Prime Minister a good soft-boiled egg and stand over him while he ate every bite. She wanted to tell him to have a long sleep and not worry about how bomb machines worked. She wanted to tell him they would do their jobs, never fear, so he should go home and get some rest before he dropped dead. She had to clasp her hands to stop from doing up his overcoat as he turned to leave. Maybe her concern showed in her eyes, because Churchill, the most powerful man in the Western world, Adolf Hitler's chief antagonist, dropped one heavy eyelid in a wink. Mab clapped a hand over her mouth, but the splutter of laughter got through. Wren Stevens looked appalled, but the PM gave a nod and said cheerily,
I must head along to congratulate the chaps behind these splendid machines.
They all looked at each other breathlessly as the door thumped shut.
The machines are already stopped, someone said. No one else will be working while he's here.
They all raced outside, following discreetly in the wake of the ministerial party. Churchill and his followers disappeared into Hut 8, and Mab saw to her surprise that one of the men left outside was Francis Grey.
What are you doing here? She said low-voiced as he came to join her by the tennis court.
I didn't think you worked at Downing Street.
No, the Foreign Office.
He smiled, coat stirring about his knees.
The call came from Downing Street this morning. They were short a driver, and looking for someone who had already been to BP, so they wouldn't have to use one of the ordinary drivers who hadn't been vetted at this level. Nobody needed me. So here I am.
I haven't seen you since dinner at the Savoy, Mab replied. When was that? May?
Russia joining the Allies made things rather busy after that.
Hopefully the Yanks will get off their arses and follow Uncle Joe's example.
She said arses deliberately, hoping for a laugh. Francis Grey had never once laughed that she could remember, but he just gave his usual smile of remote warmth. The Prime Minister toured huts 8 and 6 in turn, and there was quite a crowd by the time he came out. Mab saw Osla on the other side and was pleased to see even her cosmopolitan friend goggling at the sight of Churchill. Mab expected the PM to head back to his car, but he hesitated, looking around, before climbing up on some building rubble. Mab's throat caught, and she found herself pressing closer along with everyone else. He stood a moment, one hand thrust in his vest pocket.
"To look at you, one would not think you held so many secrets," he said conversationally. "But I know better, and I'm proud of you. Here you are, working every day, working so very hard. I must thank you all for that."
He stopped, looking down. Mab had heard him speak many times over the radio, had felt his confidence and his sheer force of will. But now he was just a rather short man standing on a heap of debris, clearly speaking around a lump in his throat, and she found tears in her eyes.
"You should know how very important your skills are to the war effort," he went on. "Nothing could be more important, even if so few in Britain know what you're doing."
He gave his sudden, ebullient smile, and Mab tingled all the way to her fingertips.
"You're my golden geese, you know. The geese who lay precious golden eggs, but never cackle."
A roar went up from the crowd, and Mab realized she was roaring too, banging her hands together in applause. If a flight of German bombers had streaked across the sky to Strath-Bletchley Park, every person there would have flung their body over the Prime Minister. Mab would have been at the front of the rush. He gave a final wave, then stumped off in the direction of the mansion, phalanx of officials closing around him. The crowd lingered a moment, everyone talking excitedly, before heads of huts began waving their people back to work. Mab realized she'd left her hat hanging on a tree branch in the middle of the rounders game. Dashing to get it, she saw Francis waiting in front of the mansion, smoking a woodbine.
"Waiting on the PM," she called, reaching for her hat.
"You know what I heard him say to Denniston as they went in?"
A smile.
"I know I told you not to leave a stone unturned recruiting for this place, but I did not mean you to take me quite so seriously."
Mab laughed. "We're a lot of odd ducks here, no question." "Oh, no." Francis raised his eyebrows. "The brim got crumpled." Mab held up her new hat, a jet black, dramatically brimmed take on a man's fedora, garnet red silk band around the crown. Mab knew it made her look like a cross between Snow White and the Wicked Queen, and it was probably the last pretty thing she'd be able to buy herself for months. "You have no idea how important hats are to women."
"Enlighten me."
"Hats aren't rationed, at least not yet. I've sent most of my clothing coupons for the year to my aunt in Sheffield. She's looking after my sister, and she doesn't particularly want to, so I keep her sweet with a few coupons in the post. She'll get a new coat, and I'll make do till next year, but at least I can still get a new hat."
Mab sauntered toward the nearest ground floor window, settling the hat over her head. She knew she was babbling. What was it about this man that made her feel the need to fill all the silences?
"We ladies pinch and make do when it comes to darning stockings and using boot black for eyeliner, but at least we can top a worn-out ensemble with a really smashing hat. That's very good for morale in wartime."
His voice sounded odd.
"Is it?"
"Of course."
Mab surveyed her dim reflection in the window, brim slashing across her forehead.
"We can't do anything about the hours or the shift changes or the airless huts, but we can look smart as we head off to war every day. The Bletchley Park Theatrical Society is cooking up a song about that for this year's Christmas review. I've already heard them practicing."
She turned, hands on hips, and sang,
"Sophisticated black is de rigueur, and a smart hat a woman's creed de coeur."
She finished with a flourish, knowing she couldn't sing. He was silent, cigarette burning between two still fingers, and her smile faded.
"Mr. Grey, I officially give up trying to figure you out. You obviously find my conversation torturous."
She checked her watch.
"Well, I've got to get back."
"Marry me."
She blinked.
"What?"
He didn't repeat it. He stood there in the cold breeze, chestnut hair stirring, just looking at her. And there was no shield of distant amusement anymore. The veils had dropped away behind his eyes, Mab thought, revealing something that blazed like a torch. She tried a smile. Are you joking with me? That seemed quite a bit more likely than getting a marriage proposal from a man she hardly knew.
No,
he said, flicking the cigarette away. There was an odd note in his voice, as if he were as confused by the offer as she.
Marry me.
Bemusement in his tone or not, his gaze was steady. How she dreamed of this moment, when some gentleman whose boots Jeff Irving and his filthy friends weren't fit to lick would make her an offer. She'd thought she'd been command of things, having nurtured her suitor along a steady procession of milestones, until he was brought to the precipice and thought it was all his own idea. Francis Gray hadn't hit any of the milestones. They'd gone on 3 dates, and Mab had done 90% of the talking on all 3 occasions. Mr. Gray, you've caught me by surprise.
It's ridiculous, really, he said. I'm sure there are far younger and more pleasant fellows making you offers. Still, I'm throwing my hat in the ring.
Why? Mab heard herself ask. You don't know me. But he did, she thought. All the talking she'd done, he'd listened. She was the one who didn't know him, much as she'd tried. He was silent nearly an entire minute, gazing at her as if he could see through her. He started to speak, then fell silent again. He reached out, touched the wing of her eyebrow, touched her cheekbone, touched her lips.
I know you.
He wound a strand of her hair around his fingers and tugged her closer. She could have pulled away, but she let herself sink against him instead. Such a light kiss, to leave her so pinned in place.
Marry me, he said, lips still brushing hers.
Yes, she heard herself whispering back into his. Her heart wasn't fluttering in her chest as she'd thought it would. It thumped slow and hard, as if too astonished to speed up. Francis Gray, war poet and Foreign Office official, had proposed marriage. She had said yes. She tried to catch her breath, collect her thoughts. Who knew what had swept those curtains of polite distance away from his eyes and made him blurt out a proposal? But who cared? 3-day wartime marriages blossomed all over Britain. She'd have been an absolute fool to turn him down. He was everything she'd dared to hope for in a husband, and more. Kindness, courtesy, education, career. Maybe he was a little older, but that meant he was steady, established, not some callow boy. Perhaps she didn't know him very well, but she had the rest of her life to figure him out. It was all so much more than she had hoped for. His fingers untangled from her hair, picked up her hand instead, turned it, looking at her long fingers lying across his broad palm.
This isn't very good timing, he said, and gave a short laugh. Next week I'm being sent to America.
Mab blinked. America?
Washington, D.C. I'm afraid I can't say anything more, but I'll be overseas for months.
He hesitated, and Mab could tell it wouldn't take much to be married within the week, before he left. To say, let's run up to London and get it done. Servicemen and their girlfriends did it all the time, squeezing a wedding into a 2-day leave. Mab nearly suggested it, but bit her tongue. She was not going to race down the aisle without a few cautionary checks first. She'd known too many girls in Shoreditch who'd married in haste and repented at leisure. We'll do it when you get back, she said, giving his hand a squeeze. Just promise you'll meet my mother and sister before you go. If she was hoping to bring Lucy into her home as a married woman, she had to see how Francis responded to that idea, and how he got on with Lucy. If he put his foot down on it, well, that was that. But she didn't think he would. He was going to love Lucy, and she'd have every advantage in the world. Snow-white socks and a day-school blazer and a pony. Damn it. Francis glanced over his shoulder. There was motion at the door of the mansion as the ministerial party began to move outside.
10 more minutes, that's all I ask.
He looked up at her.
It will be a bit of a wait for you. Overseas post being what it is, I don't know how often I'll be able to write.
As long as you let me know when you arrive safe, she said softly. Worry was already clutching hard in her stomach. Surely diplomats went back and forth across the Atlantic all the time. It wasn't like the convoys getting targeted by German wolf packs. He'll be perfectly safe, she told herself. As soon as he came back, they'd be married.
This man was going to be her husband. She'd make him the best bloody wife in Britain.
Tea next week with your family, then, before I leave.
Frances passed his thumb over her knuckles.
Do you want a ring?
Yes, she heard herself laugh. I want a ring.
Bound to be a ruby somewhere in London that matches your lips.
He let go of her hand, backed up toward the little fleet of cars. The Prime Minister had already climbed inside, and his chauffeur was starting up. The aides hovered by the next vehicle, waiting for their driver. Frances looked at Mab another long moment, the curtain still swept aside from his naked gaze. No one had ever looked at Mab like that in her life. Her fiancé climbed into the car. It moved off, and Mab walked, still in a daze, back toward her hut. Mab Gray, she thought. Mrs. Gray. Mab saw Winston Churchill's face turned out the window of the lead car as it swept around the drive toward the gates. She put up her hand and flashed a V with two fingers, his famous sign. V for victory. Because today she'd won, damn it. She'd won. The Prime Minister put a hand out the window and flashed a V back. Chapter 28. From Bletchley Blethering's, October 1941. Preoccupied, adjective, engrossed in thought, taken to an entirely new level by BP personnel, who are frequently too preoccupied to notice if they have put their knickers on backward, if the Prime Minister has dropped in for tea, or if everything except the pencil actually in their hand is on fire. Beth missed everything that autumn. Churchill's visit, Mab's engagement, it all passed Beth in a blur. Honestly, where do you cottage girls go? Osler demanded. The blinking moon? Beth just stared, exhausted. She was sleeping very badly. At night, her brain roiled so much with five-letter groups and quartets of wheels. She was lucky if she got more than a few hours of tossing and turning. Boots had given up sleeping on her feet and retired in disgust to the basket on the floor.
MI5 manages the controlled German agents,
Dilly had mused aloud at the beginning, with his usual complete disregard for Bletchley Park's paranoia about keeping its workers in the dark.
MI5 makes them send out false information on their own wireless transmitters, as directed by our case officers, using their own hand cipher given to them by the Germans. Their controllers are usually in Lisbon, Madrid, or Paris. They analyze everything before transmitting to Berlin. We just need to crack the one they use to make sure Berlin is swallowing it.
But just hadn't happened yet, even though Dilly's entire section had been banging their brains against it for 3 months so far. This wasn't like the 3-day sprint they'd flung themselves into to break the Matapan battle orders. Excruciating, but finite. This was a desperate, endless slog of dead ends, going down one promising path until it petered out, then trying another, with no time for recovery or rest.
If I analyze the hand cipher traffic from the individual network, we should get some good cribs, Dilly muttered.
But he'd been analyzing the traffic all this time, and nothing consistent came up. With Italian naval enigma, cribs gave you something to rod for. Here they had nothing. It was those damned four wheels used in the Abwehr enigma, turning over much more frequently with no predictable pattern. Have to crack it. Have to crack it. Her entire body was tense as wire, and she was so far down the rabbit hole she felt like screaming. If she screamed, she'd probably scream in five-letter clumps. Have to crack it. Beth wasn't going anywhere except the cottage, where she overstayed her shifts and barely came home in time to walk boots before being hauled into the kitchen. Then she'd stand stirring rice pudding over the heat, watching boxing chains unspool in her head, until her mother had her by the elbow, shaking her.
Bethan, you've burned it!
5 minutes later, Beth would realize she'd gone sideways in her thoughts all over again, not listening to a word of the lecture. Sometimes she managed to mumble, I'm sorry, Mother, what were you saying? And Mrs. Finch would walk away, quivering with anger, saying,
I think you're going mad, I really do.
I think so too, Beth sometimes thought. Dilly burst into the cottage one interminable night shift, waving his glasses.
Lobsters!
Beth traded looks with Phyllida at the next desk.
Lobsters?
When Dilly was in one of his Catherine Wheel moods and started firing ideas off like sparks, it was best to patiently ask questions until he started making sense. Peggy was better at it than Beth, who knew she wasn't making much sense these days herself. Only yesterday she'd noticed the big ruby glinting on Mab's hand and said, "How long have you had that?" Mab had looked at her a little strangely and said, "A month, Beth. Francis gave it to me before he went overseas, after I took him to meet Mum and Lucy. After there was that tempest in a teapot the high-ups made about the new Agatha Christie book." Osler had prompted when Beth looked blank. "Don't tell me you forgot that too." Beth had, apparently, and now she was being asked to think about lobsters.
"The moment all four wheels in the machine turn over between the first two letters of the indicator and again in its repeat position, think of that as a crab."
Dilly waved four fingers like crab legs all moving together. "It's not a way into the cipher." Beth poured cold coffee into a cup and pushed it into his hand.
"But if there are four wheel turnovers on both sides of the throw-on indicator key block, there could be more turnovers on one side of the key block alone. Think of that as a lobster."
He made lobster claw gestures, spilling coffee, jabbering as Beth listened. Nothing made sense, but she was used to Dilly's Lewis Carroll logic by now and found her brain diving down the right angle he'd just proposed. "If we could find your lobster," she said slowly, "and a long block of text after it, maybe we'd have better luck breaking key blocks of indicators on the same setting." She didn't really know where she was going with that yet, but the best way to find out was to have a go, as Dilly always said. Beth pulled out the pencil stub holding her knotted up hair. "Let's go lobster hunting." It took 4 days to find a message with the right turnover, but as soon as Beth had it, numbers started spiraling and chaining madly. "Yes!" she yelped in the middle of the day shift. "Give me a cipher letter pairing in position one. I can chain together some deductions about the other pairings." Her words tumbled madly. "Don't you see?" she finished in a rush, blood fizzing. Phyllida rubbed the bridge of her nose.
"Sort of."
Peggy peered closer.
"Show me."
"Where's Dilly?" Beth looked around. "Did he go home?"
"Yes, he did."
Peggy's face was drawn.
"And we aren't bothering him. Show me."
It had gone October, trees flaming yellow and orange around the lake, by the time Beth could crack one wheel setting. November frosts had hardened the ground before the cottage girls could theorize how often the German technicians, when they picked four-letter wheel settings for the day's traffic, fell back on particular words. Nine, Wein, Neun. "Four-letter names, too," Peggy mused. Then Beth broke a wheel setting on some Balkan-based traffic after she broke SA for the two right-hand wheels and made a grainy-eyed dawn-hour guess that the Balkan operator had a girlfriend named Rosa. With R and O fixed in position, everything fell into place. Generated alphabets of text and cipher could then be swiftly buttoned up, and lists of four-letter German names and words were soon pinned up on every cottage wall.
"We're getting there," Dilly encouraged, sprinkling tobacco all over Beth's work. "It's coming, ladies."
In early December, the moment came. Everyone clustered around Beth's desk, barely breathing as she pulled blocks of German out of the chaos. There it was, a decrypted message. The German-speaking woman confirmed it was legible. Beth didn't ask or care what it said. She put her knuckles to her mouth and bit down savagely, little dying fragments of code spasming across her vision. She was suddenly hungry and didn't know when she'd last eaten, didn't know when she'd last been home or what day it was. She didn't know anything except that she'd done it. They'd all done it. They'd broken the spy enigma. Peggy swayed where she stood at Beth's shoulder. She put her head in her hands, and suddenly the silence snapped. Phyllida threw herself into the arms of the puzzled tea lady, who had just trundled in with fresh chicory coffee. Several girls laughed as if they were drunk, several cried, all so finely balanced between elation and exhaustion they couldn't speak a single coherent word. At last, Peggy lifted her head from her hands, looking like she was swimming up through deep water, and said, "I'll telephone Dilly, then inform Commander Denniston." She reached for the message on Beth's desk, giving Beth's shoulder a fierce squeeze. Someone else was looking at the schedule, calling out the girls who were on until midnight.
"Beth, it's your day off tomorrow. Go home before you drop."
Beth struggled into her coat and stumbled outside, winter chill striking her in the face. It was full dark, but whether it was 6 o'clock or midnight, she had no idea. Beth's ears were roaring as she came out of the stable yard,
and it took her a fuddled moment to realize the roar wasn't in her head. It was coming from the mansion. Men and women were spilling out the front door, shouting, laughing, calling out to each other.
You heard?
I heard.
About bloody time.
What?
Beth called, buffeted by the stream of ecstatic codebreakers.
What happened?
She caught sight of a familiar red-banded, slant-brimmed hat and caught Mab's elbow.
What is it?
Mab threw her arms around Beth, all her usual cool poise gone.
They're in, Beth. The Americans are in the war. The Japanese attacked one of their bases.
They did?
Don't tell me you missed that too. Pearl Harbor?
Mab took a gulping breath.
The announcement was coming. We all knew it. Everybody's been cramming into the mansion around the radio. Not an hour ago, President Roosevelt came on, and the Yanks are in it.
America in the war, and the spy enigma broken. After so many months of hoping and waiting for both, they'd come all at once. Beth took a shaky breath and began sobbing. She stood there with tears pouring down her face, utterly spent and utterly, utterly happy. Mab put an arm around her shoulder and squeezed, a flash of light from the mansion sparking red fire off her ruby ring.
Cry all you want. I won't tell. Have you got a day off tomorrow, like Oz and me? We all need to sleep late.
By the time Beth had cried herself into hiccuping silence against Mab's shoulder, she was limp as a dish rag, and Ozla had found them.
Darlings, isn't it topping?
She and Mab stared Beth between them as they headed for home, chattering excitedly. The world was coming back to Beth's eyes in its usual shapes by the time they came through the Finch door, and as she unbuttoned her coat, she called eagerly,
Did you hear, Dad? Have you got the radio on?
We heard.
Beth's father came into the corridor smiling.
Lovely news, lovely. The war will be over in no time. Mabel, your fiancé telephoned. He's back from America earlier than expected.
Mab paled.
My God, did he sail in the middle of...
No, he was back day before yesterday. Said he was quite as surprised by Pearl Harbor as we were. He's at his London digs if you want to ring.
Beth's father smiled indulgently as Mab flew for the telephone, but that smile shuttered as he looked back at Beth.
Your mother's in the kitchen. She's had a very difficult day.
Beth kissed her father's cheek, blew into the kitchen and flung her arms around her mother's waist where she stood at the stove.
Isn't it wonderful news? Let me take over. I know I've been gone forever. You wouldn't believe the workload.
The exhaustion and frustration of the past months were fading like a dream. The first message had been broken. They'd break more.
I can break anything, Beth thought, smiling. Give me a pencil and a crib, and I'll crack the world.
She reached for an apron, looking around.
Where's Boots?
She was hours overdue to take him out.
Do set the table.
Her mother kept stirring.
Yes, it's lovely news. Though when I think of those poor people in Pearl Harbor, let me take Boots out, then I'll set the table.
Beth whistled, but no woolly grey shape trundled crossly into the room.
I told you, Bethan.
Her mother looked up from the pot she was stirring, her smile serene.
I told you that dog was out if it ever made a mess in the house. You said you'd always be home to take it out. I told you.
Beth took a step, suddenly numb.
What did you do? Boots!
Beth caught her foot on a stone, stumbling. Bletchley after sundown was a black pit, every chink of light battened down. She had a torch, but it was pasted over with regulation paper, so only a shadowy beam emerged. A village she'd walked her entire life suddenly became an alien landscape.
Boots!
Her dog had made a puddle in the parlour when Beth was late coming home, and her mother had taken him by the collar, put him outside into the dark street, and shut the door.
Now, Beth, her father had said, placating, see it from your mother's side.
But Beth had grabbed the torch and run straight out into the street, forgetting everything except that her dog was blundering through the winter night alone. She stumbled again, filling her lungs in a hitching sob.
Boots!
A chink of light showed down the street as a door opened, the indistinct ripple of Osler's voice.
Pardon me, have you seen...
Mab had the other torch, looking in the opposite direction. They'd followed Beth without a moment's hesitation, as Beth's mother stood with arms folded, shaking her head more in sorrow than in anger.
I told you what would happen, Bethan. You can't blame me.
Yes, I can, Beth thought. But she couldn't focus on the flickering rage,
Despair welled up over it. How was she going to find one small dog in the middle of the night? He was gone, the longed-for dog she'd claimed in the most monumental act of will of her life. He was gone, and she was never going to find him. Or if she did, it would only be his body, half-eaten by foxes or crushed by a car careening through on the way to London. She screamed into the dark, ripping the paper off the torch. Boots! Beth? Mab's voice. Beth reversed, stumbled toward the bouncing beam of Mab's torch, heart suddenly cannoning inside her ribs. Mab's tall shape formed up in the black, clutching a small, shivering bundle. Found him under a bush 4 houses down, Mab said. He didn't go far. Stop snapping at me, you little bugger. I'm on your side. Beth pulled her dog into her arms and for the second time that day sobbed all over Mab's shoulder. The schnauzer was damp and smelly and quivering with cold, her umphing like a cross old man when she hugged him too hard. Beth didn't know if she'd ever be able to put him down.
There'd better be a good reason you girls are making a ruckus, a disapproving voice sounded.
One of the civilian ARP wardens, busybodies all.
Uncovered lights despite blackout regulations.
Mab switched her torch off, and Oslo caught up and began pouring verbal honey. They got rid of him and turned for home, steering Beth between them. With Boots safe, a hot spark of something diamond hard had lodged itself in Beth's throat, and with every step toward her house, it grew bigger.
Is your mother going to let you?
Oslo began, and then stopped. Beth came to the door, tugged her mother's jumper off the coat rack, and rubbed Boots dry right there in the entryway. She could see Mrs. Finch's shoes on the hooked rug, but refused to look up. Osler and Mab crowded in behind, making bright noises about how cold it was outside. But the silence under their exclamations stretched like a sheet of ice. Beth didn't raise her eyes until Boots was dry and had stopped shivering. Then she straightened, meeting her mother's gaze expressionlessly. Mrs. Finch heaved a gentle, put-upon sigh.
It can stay one more night, Bethan. If tomorrow you find it somewhere else to...
Beth didn't plan it, didn't think about it, didn't even know it was happening until she saw her hand flash up and hit her mother across the face. She'd never hit anyone before in her life. She'd probably hurt her hand more than she'd hurt its target. But Mrs. Finch fell back, fingertips flying to her own cheek in shock. And Beth fell back a step too in horror.
I didn't mean to, she almost said.
But she had meant to.
I'm sorry,
she almost said, but she wasn't sorry. The diamond spark of rage in her throat was still burning, larger and larger. She couldn't think what to say, so all she said was,
How dare you?
Red-faced, Mrs. Finch reached for her Bible.
He that smiteth his father or his mother shall surely...
Beth didn't wait for her to finish Exodus 21:15, or extend the book and tell her to hold it up until her arms burned.
No. What did you say to me?
Out of sheer habit, Beth almost dropped her eyes and fiddled with the end of her plait. But when her fingers reached for the wispy end of the long braid, which she'd spent her whole life hanging on to like a lifeline rather than meet anyone's eyes, it wasn't there. She had a smart, shoulder-skimming wave now, and she had a dog and a circle of friends and a job breaking German ciphers. So Beth said very quietly,
I'm not holding the Bible up for the next half hour while you harangue me, and you are not throwing my dog out.
We'll discuss it tomorrow.
Beth's father spoke loud enough to make everyone jump.
We're all overwrought, this news about the Americans.
But Mrs. Finch rode over him, eyes filled with tears.
Why are you behaving like this, Bethan? Why? You haven't been the same since that job. Why is this about my job?
Beth had to raise her own voice to be heard.
You threw my dog out. What kind of person would...
You didn't have to take that job. They don't need you.
Yes, they do.
Beth threw her head back.
There isn't anyone there who can do what I do.
And what is it you do?
Mrs. Finch's voice rose.
If it's so important, tell me. Tell me right now.
Beth refused to get sidetracked down that path.
I won't apologize for taking the job at BP.
Ever since she'd started working, all she'd done at home was apologize for it. No more.
Your job is here. You're my little helper. What am I supposed to do without extra hands at home? I help you every minute I'm home. I'm happy to help. And you still threw my dog out in the damn street.
You care more for a dog and a job than your own mother.
Mrs. Finch pressed a hand against her temple.
Your own mother, who isn't well.
Mab's voice sounded behind Beth, amused and contemptuous.
Here comes the headache.
Right on schedule, Ozla agreed.
Don't you talk back to me, you two tarts, Mrs. Finch snapped. Encouraging my Bethan to behave like a common...
A common what? Suddenly Beth's words were pouring out.
Mother, I work for the war effort. I meet with friends to talk about books. I have the occasional glass of sherry. Why does any of that make me a tart?
Mrs. Finch poked her Bible at Beth.
Do not profane your daughter by making her a harlot.
Beth swatted the book out of her hands to the floor.
I'm not doing anything wrong, and you bloody well know it. So why does it bother you?
I didn't give you permission to...
I am 25 years old.
It's my house. You'll obey my rules.
BP pays me a salary of £150 a year, and I give it all to you. I've earned the right to...
Mrs. Finch seized Beth's arm. For the first time, Beth put her hands to her mother's shoulders and shoved her back. The skin inside her elbow stung, and she realized how unerringly her mother's strong fingers always found that spot where the flesh was the most tender. She couldn't remember the last time her arms hadn't been bruised blue.
Please.
Beth's father stood wringing his hands.
Can we all have a cup of tea and...
Where were you when she put my dog out?
Beth rounded on him. The spark of rage had grown to a cloud, billowing up inside her throat, choking her.
Why didn't you stop her? Or why didn't you get out of your armchair and take him out yourself when I was working late, so he didn't make a mess in the first place?
Well...
Mr. Finch shifted, uncomfortable.
She said I shouldn't.
It's your house too, Beth cried. But you never tell her no. Do it, Dad. Tell her I can keep my dog. Tell her to stop badgering me. Tell her to stop.
Mrs. Finch folded her arms tight, a spot of colour burning high in each cheek.
I want that dog gone, and that is final.
Silence. Boots whined beside Beth's feet. She could feel Ozla and Mab behind her like sentinels. Mr. Finch cleared his throat, opened his mouth, shut it again. Mrs. Finch gave a sharp nod, eyes boring into Beth.
What do you have to say now, miss?
If the dog goes, so do I, Beth said, drawing a long breath.
And the next time you get a headache, you can wring out your own washcloth, you Sunday school bully.
This time it was Mrs. Finch's hand that whipped out. Beth stepped back and the blow missed. Mr. Finch seized his wife's arm before she could swing again.
Muriel, Beth, let's sit down.
No.
Beth turned away and fumbled her coat on, numb and shaking.
I'm going.
So are we.
Mab brushed past Mrs. Finch, Ozla marching straight after her. A moment later, Beth heard their footsteps up the creaky stairs, heard the bedroom door open, heard the sound of travelling cases sliding out from under beds. Mrs. Finch turned a mottled red, lips pressing together in a tight line. Beth looked at her another long, dreadful moment, then turned away to fetch her handbag and a lead for boots. She knew she should go upstairs and gather some things, but she couldn't make herself retreat even one step further into the house. The dreadful stillness spread and spread. In no time at all, Mab and Ozla clattered back downstairs, carrying not just their own travelling cases, but Beth's, exploding with hastily stuffed slips and blouses.
The road you are walking leads to hell, Mrs. Finch said, white with fury.
At least you won't be there, said Beth.
The three of them walked out of the house where Beth had lived all her life, boots trotting at their heels, and shut the door behind them.
Chapter 29.
As far as Mab knew, princes married princesses, not Canadian commoners. Therefore, Philip of Greece had no business making Ozla fall head over heels, and Mab wasn't prepared to warm to him. Still, she had to admit he was a looker as he picked the three of them up from Euston Station in his rakish little Vauxhall, fair hair rumpled.
Hello, princess, he greeted Ozla,
and his grin made even Mab's impervious pulse flutter.
I hear you and your damsels are in need of rescuing.
No duffing about, Philip. We barely escaped with our lives.
Ozla leaned over the Vauxhall's door to kiss him, and though it was a brief kiss, the heat of it made Mab wonder if that midnight talk about the facts of life had come just in time.
Philip, meet Mab Chert and Beth Finch, Ozla continued. The three of us are temporarily homeless and absolutely knackered. Philip hopped out and shook hands. Mab did her best to look like she met princes every day, and Beth spoke for the first time since leaving Bletchley on the train they'd caught by the tips of their fingers. Do you have anything to drink?
Fizz, coming right up.
Philip's eyes gleamed as he threw their bags in the boot. So, why the SOS so late at night?
I sense a story.
Ozla shrugged. Beth's mother flipped her wicket. Bitch, Mab couldn't help muttering. I'm sorry, Beth, but she is.
She is,
Beth agreed. She looked pale and wrung out, climbing in the back seat with Boots. But Mab thought something inside Beth had unwound somehow. It had left her shaky but defiant, shoulders squared as never before.
Hurrah, Beth,
Mab thought with a rush of pride as the Vauxhall shot off into the night. Wherever the BP billeting officer bunked them next, it simply couldn't be worse than Mrs. Finch. No more nosy questions, no more leathery Walton pie.
Claridge's, darling,
Ozla was saying to Philip. My mother's at Kelburn Castle on a house party, so her suite's empty. The hall porter at Claridge's greeted Ozla like a long-lost niece, and Mab and Beth like royalty.
A gentleman waiting inside for you, Miss Chert. A Mr. Grey.
Mab flew inside. The Art Deco hotel court, with its glittering chandelier and black-and-white tiles, was thronged with women in satin and men in uniform, champagne corks popping as everyone celebrated the Americans entering the war. To Mab, that already felt like it had happened a year ago. She craned her head, and there was Francis, standing, hands in his pockets, watching the party with that air of distant enjoyment she knew so well. He looked less tanned. Evidently he hadn't seen much sun these last 2 months in America. But the smile was the same.
Francis!
She called. And there was a moment's awkwardness as they both hovered, visibly wondering whether to embrace or shake hands. They hadn't worked any of that out yet. They hadn't worked anything out, really, though they'd been engaged since September. Finally, Mab stepped forward and kissed his cheek. He smelled like sandalwood, and his hair looked so soft she wanted to run her hands through it, but she didn't quite dare.
I didn't think you'd be able to meet me on such short notice.
Mab had managed to ring him from Bletchley Station, but what a way to reunite after nearly 3 months.
You look well.
His eyes went over her, that look that made her feel naked.
Your family, they're well too.
Yes, Lucy's back in London with Mum now that the bombings have tailed off.
Francis had met them both 2 days before he left for America. Mab's mother had been flustered by the posh tea room, and Lucy had been wary, not at all convinced that this stranger wasn't going to take Mab even more away than she already was. But Francis had been friendly, unflappable, and he hadn't raised even a hint of an eyebrow at Mab's post-tea room suggestion that Lucy might live with them. With that, Mab had exhaled her last bit of caution. It was all going to be just fine. Another silence fell.
I wish we'd been able to write more.
Mab tried not to sound accusatory. Overseas post was spotty, and telephone calls cost a fortune. Francis had sent a telegram when he'd arrived in Washington, but there had only been postcards afterward. It had been difficult not to wonder if he was regretting his offer, if he'd come back wondering what he'd been thinking when he folded that big ruby into her hand.
I can't believe it's been nearly 3 months, she said brightly.
2 months, 1 week, and 4 days, he said.
And the knot of anxiety in Mab's stomach eased. If a man was counting the days, it wasn't because he was looking to take his ring back.
How was Washington?
Not much I can tell you, I'm afraid. Busy, cold, too many Americans. Your work?
Not much I can tell you, I'm afraid. Busy, hot, too many machines.
Another exchange of smiles, a visible sense of wondering if they should join hands or kiss again, or... Surely we'll learn to talk to each other, Mab thought, once we're married. Once they could do their not talking in a bed. Mab wished they could get on with that side of things now. His tie was rumpled, and something in her was rising, wanting to yank it off.
Give away nothing for free, the steely voice in the back of her mind said.
The voice that had held her upright when Geoffrey Irving and his friends left her on the side of the street.
Give away nothing for free. Even at the 11th hour.
By this time, the others had squammed through the celebratory crowd.
Introductions were made. Osler embellished the story of their departure. Beth was an absolute brick. And Philip went off to order Bollinger and came back with brimming coupes. Beth slugged hers with surprising speed.
Steady on, he said
as she swallowed the second glass before he'd half refilled it.
I just told my mother she was a Sunday school bully, Beth said.
Drink up.
He refilled her glass before turning to Francis.
You're a lucky man, Mr. Grey. When's the happy day?
Francis looked at Mab, one of those quiet glances with something burning behind it.
I'm leaving London again day after tomorrow, he said. No time to arrange a proper wedding and honeymoon until I get back. 3 more weeks.
Or there's the registry office, Mab heard herself saying. What about tomorrow? Mr. Gibbs, Osler said, descending on the hall porter with a ravishing smile. My friend is getting married tomorrow, and she's going to need a slap-up wedding party. Can you help me?
Yes, Miss Kendall,
he replied, not batting an eyelash.
Good. Bollinger, enough to get all London kippered. And the best wedding breakfast rationing will allow. How many eggs can you get your hands on? Foie gras? What about beluga? Put it on my mother's bill. I'm also going to need the room number of every guest currently staying in this hotel with a daughter aged...
Osler looked back at Mab.
How old is Lucy?
Nearly 6, Mab choked, helpless with laughter.
Between the ages of 5 and 7,
Osler finished to Gibbs.
Please send notes to all their parents and beg emergency morning loan of their daughter's best frock. I will be by at 9 sharp tomorrow morning to inspect the selection.
I'm not sure I...
Don't let me down, Mr. Gibbs.
Osler pressed a wad of bills into his hand and turned, hands on hips, a general surveying the troops.
Francis, I'm sending you home so your bride can get her beauty sleep. Come back at 11 tomorrow in your best suit, with rings and whatever bits of paper one needs for a marriage license. Philip, if you can collect Mab's mother and sister tomorrow morning at 9 and deliver them to Cyclix around the corner, where we'll get our faces done. Your mother's address, Mab?
Mab, giggling, gave it.
Mum is going to faint, being chauffeured to my wedding by a prince.
Right.
Philip grinned, clearly thinking it the best lark in the world to use up his precious petrol coupons in a mad dash across London for a Shoreditch mother of the bride. Mab's urge to distrust him melted.
Come on, old man.
The prince clapped Francis on the shoulder.
I'll drop you home tonight. I might know a chap who can grease the wheels at the registry office.
Excellent. We convene here at 11 tomorrow, and you slackers will not be late. Say goodbye to your fiancé, Mab. You and I have a closet to raid.
Grabbing the bottle of Bollinger and 3 glasses, Osler headed for the stairs. Beth followed with boots, and after a hasty kiss to Francis, Mab floated along behind, still laughing.
My mother's suite, Osler said, waving them into the opulent set of rooms with its massive bed,
the bathroom with its huge tub and shining mirrors.
You can borrow it for your wedding, you and Francis. Mr. Gibbs can find Beth and me another bunk.
All right, Mab said immediately. She'd been prepared for a wedding night in Francis's bachelor digs before he left London and she departed for Bletchley. But my God, did she want a night of luxury if it was on offer. Not just because she'd never stayed in a sumptuous hotel, but because surely it would be easier to get to know a brand new, all but silent husband when he was surrounded by satin sheets and champagne in ice buckets. Mab swigged from her coupe, feeling the first surge of wedding nerves. She was a bride. She was getting married tomorrow. To a man she'd only met 6 times.
Beth, keep the fizz topped.
Osler yanked open her mother's wardrobe and began flinging dresses around.
Now, a scrummy frock that will pass as a wedding gown. Your mother's going to know if I raid her rack of Hartnells, Mab yelped. She'll never miss one, and you are not getting married in your blue curtain liner, Scarlett O'Hara.
Osler held up a dress, long-sleeved, tight-waisted, cream satin pleats cascading from the waist in devastating knife-edge folds.
This one!
Mab coveted that dress more than air.
I can't.
Osler paid absolutely no attention, bless her.
It won't hit the ground on you, since Mama's much shorter, so we'll hem it to the knee.
Knee length is better for a day wedding anyway.
Now, for Beth, we'll be your bridesmaids, of course. This smoke blue chiffon would look scrumptious with some sashing.
This has been a very strange night, Beth said, sitting on the bed, drinking straight from the champagne bottle. She looked tipsy and tired, but a smile hovered at the corners of her lips.
A very strange night, she repeated,
looking at Boots ensconced on the nearest down pillow, snoring. Osler raised her glass, beautiful alabaster face flushed pink.
To Mrs. Grey!
And to you, Oz.
Mab lifted her own glass. And Beth. She wanted to say something about what they meant, the two of them. How she'd never in her life had such friends. But she didn't have the words to explain how much she felt, so she just raised her champagne, throat choked.
To Bletchley Park!
10 days until the royal wedding. November 10, 1947. Chapter 30. York. Osler could feel the waiter of Betty's tea room hovering, irritated that the woman in the scarlet new look coat and smart black toque hadn't ordered yet. Osler kept watch through the floor-to-ceiling windows for Mab's tall figure hurrying across the square, but couldn't stop looking at the shop sign. Betty's. The lack of apostrophe was driving her potty. Why couldn't people punctuate properly, for God's sake? And suddenly Mab was standing in the doorway, dressed in the latest go. Huge skirted midnight blue coat, tiny sapphire blue hat tilted over one eye at an insolent angle. Black pearls at her ears and throat. Her gaze crossed the room to Osler with the force of a rifle shot. Take the high road if she pulls out her claws, Osler told herself, gazing back without smiling. Stick to the matter at hand.
Tea?
The waiter sprang forward as Mab rustled through the nest of little tables and elegantly dressed women, and sank down at the table Osler had chosen, a secluded nook against a window where no one would be able to hear their conversation if they whispered.
A pot of Earl Grey, Mab said, as Osler said, Scones, please.
The waiter whisked off, and Mab arched those scimitar eyebrows.
Scones? I thought you'd be watching your figure for the royal wedding. So much for the high road, or the matter at hand.
Such a thumping bore, Osler said airily. Can't believe I have to dig out Mama's diamonds just to park myself in that old stone heap with a stunning view of a column and absolutely nothing else.
Mab tugged off her ink-blue gloves.
You're in the papers even this far north. The scandal rags, anyway. So much speculation about whether a certain dark-haired Canadian beauty would attend Prince Philip's stag party.
You know the scandal rags.
Osler stripped off her own gloves so Mab could see the emerald.
Thank goodness my fiancé doesn't give any credence to gossip columns.
Mab admired the ring.
Pity green doesn't suit you. Does your fiancé know the reason for this little jaunt?
Naturally not, darling. I'll wager your husband doesn't either. Just like he doesn't know you chose him less for his smile and more for his assets.
I'm a practical woman, Oz. You're the one riding Tatler fluff. Fairy stories. Only in those, doesn't the girl usually get the prince in the end?
The waiter chose that moment to return with tea and scones. Flowered minton cups and saucers clattered in the charged silence. They sipped, staring daggers.
Look, let's stop talking slush, Osler said finally. Much as I would like to sit here trading unpleasantries, we have a decision to make.
Beth hovered almost visibly at the table. Mab's mocking expression shuttered, and her voice automatically dropped to a murmur, inaudible to anyone but Osler.
I have trouble believing this guff about a traitor. If someone had been selling information to the Germans, the Luftwaffe would have bombed us flat. The fact that we went through the war without being targeted proves they never found out we were reading their bloody post.
Osler had thought of that too.
They could have been running counterintelligence, feeding false information to misdirect us.
Then they wouldn't have lost.
Well, maybe it wasn't the Jerrys this traitor was selling to.
But the war's over.
Why is this still so urgent? Don't be dense. Treason has no expiration date. And her notes said this traitor is still very much a threat.
That sounds like a madwoman's paranoia to me, Mab stated.
Paranoia? Or just someone who worked at BP? Look at us.
Osler gestured around the tea room with its dazzle of crystal and silver, its brocade drapes. We picked the table furthest from the others, and even so we're whispering and breaking off every time someone walks near. When I had a tooth worked on last year, I was so worried I'd mutter something classified while sourced on chloroform, I made them do the whole procedure while I was awake. It was agony.
Long pause.
I wouldn't take anything for pain when I gave birth.
Mab stirred her tea, looking like it killed her to agree with anything Ozla said.
The same reason.
See? We're all paranoid. It's second nature by now. Beth's being cautious, not necessarily lying.
Or she believes her own story. People who are insane tend to do that.
Ozla picked a scone off the untouched plate.
If she's insane. Remember how hysterical she was at the end? We both thought,
I know, Ozla admitted. But looking back now, did she go mad or just get pushed to the brink? We were all strained to the limit by that point. I was on my beam ends. You were getting bottled every night.
I was not.
You were a blinking mess, and everyone knew it.
Mab glowered, recrossing her legs under a swath of midnight blue crinoline. You think Beth's sane, then?
Ozla looked at her scone, which she'd reduced to a pile of crumbs. Until the day she was carted away, I'd have laid money that Beth Finch was the least likely person at BP to crock up. She was a perfectly functioning machine. And even if she did crock up, she might have got better. People can.
Ozla remembered Phillips telling her how his mother had recovered from her breakdown and been released from Bellevue. Iron will, he'd guessed. Who had a more iron will than Beth?
Mab looked at her. They took simultaneous gulps of Earl Grey, and Ozla had the feeling they were both wishing it would gin. Maybe they should have met in a pub, not a tea room.
Even if she's not mad, Mab said finally, I can't swallow this idea that one of Beth's friends in Knox's section was a rat. They were supposed to be the best of the best. Who on earth could it be?
That's why we have to ask Beth. Ozla looked her in the eye.
That's why we're going to Clockwell.
Inside the clock. The asylum nurses talked of nothing but the royal wedding.
8 bridesmaids, all dressed by Hartnell. Princess Margaret, of course.
Shut up about the wedding, Beth would have liked to shout through the door of her cell. Talk about this surgery the new doctor here is so keen on, this lobotomy.
Princess Alexandra of Kent, Lady Caroline Montague Douglas Scott.
Beth turned over on her cot, trying to listen, pushing down the wet cough that had lingered since her springtime bout of pneumonia. She was trying to get an afternoon doze. Last night had stretched empty and sleepless, with the relentless seeping cold, and her bitter flashing back to the minute she'd spent on her knees before the red-haired orderly.
You know the princess had to use clothing ration coupons for her wedding dress, just like any other bride. I remember my sister's wedding during the war. She made a veil out of parlour doilies.
Beth remembered Mab's wedding in London, the dash to the registry office, Mab in her ivory satin pleats, the wedding breakfast at Claridge's of ham salad and champagne, followed by eggless cake. Little Lucy twirling in a borrowed frock of pale pink lace as Mab and Frances were practically carried upstairs to the bridal suite.
That was a beautiful day, Beth thought, swallowing more coughs.
No pompous Westminster ceremony could match it. Though, ironically, Ozla's escort to Mab's nuptials was the bridegroom of the upcoming royal wedding.
Have you seen Prince Philip's picture?
A sigh from one of the nurses outside.
So handsome.
He's German, though.
You'd think our princess could do better than a Hun.
I thought he was Greek.
He fought on our side.
Besides, the Germans aren't enemies now. I'd be a lot more worried if he was a Ruski.
Russia, the new enemy. When Beth wasn't sifting through mental evidence on who Bletchley Park's traitor might be, she pondered who they might have been working for. She was fairly certain it couldn't have been Germany. The evidence she'd decrypted had been Soviet in origin, not German. Besides, if the Nazis had had access to the kind of information that passed through Dilly's section, they would surely have targeted Bletchley. Silence outside. The nurses had moved on. Beth gave way to a fit of coughing, the sound from her lungs wet and ugly.
The pneumonia will come back this winter, she thought,
hacking into her pillow.
And this time it might kill me.
If this lobotomy surgery didn't, whatever it was. But Beth pushed that thought away. She coughed up what felt like half a lung and finally turned over, mind limping in old, spent circles. Ozla and Mab, cryptograms and traitors, Germany and Russia. The traitor had to have been working for the Soviets. The USSR and Britain had been allies back then. But that didn't mean Churchill trusted them. Beth could well imagine Uncle Joe snooping for more information than his colleagues were willing to share. And BP had always had its share of Marxist sympathisers, political dabblers from Cambridge and Oxford, who quoted Lenin and talked about the proletariat. "Which of my friends sympathised with Russia?" she wondered now, and wished for the thousandth time that she hadn't been so far inside the spirals of her work that she missed the discussions flying around her in Knox's section. Because the war against Germany might have been over, but the struggle against the Soviet Union was only beginning. And Beth, doubling over in another fit of hacking, couldn't help but wonder if the traitor who had put her here was still sending information to the USSR.
5 years ago, February 1942. Chapter 31. From Bletchley Blethering's, February 1942. The madhouse has a new warden. Commander Travis has taken over from Denniston, at least on the service side. Good luck to him controlling the inmates.
"Not you again,"
Commander Travis said ominously.
"Is that any way to greet your favourite naval section translator, sir?"
Osler grinned. The other men in Travis's office, suited types, probably London intelligence men, gave censorious frowns, but Travis just sighed.
"What is it this time? Sneaking an electric cooker ring into the signals cupboard so you could make toast on the night watch?"
"That was last week," Osler said.
"Sneaking into the new block the minute the walls were half-constructed, riding the wheeled laundry bin down the hall into the gentleman's loo?"
"2 weeks ago." Travis sighed again, looking out the window, where, distantly, off-duty codebreakers were ice-skating on the frozen lake.
"Then enlighten me."
"No pranks this time, sir." Though Osler didn't see what was wrong with a few hijinks, BP needed a little laughter to keep up morale. After the jubilation of December, everyone rejoicing in the joy of the Americans entering the war, the new year hadn't really started with a bang. The Yanks might have been in the fight, but weren't here yet, and the fall of Singapore last week, with more than 60,000 British, Indian, and Australian soldiers heading into Japanese POW camps, had plunged the entire park into gloom. And something dire was happening in Hut 8 with the German naval codes. Osler had no clue what, but Harry and the rest of his section were going around looking like absolute death.
"I'm actually here to make a point, Commander Travis," she said, bringing herself back to business.
Travis and the men behind him watched with bemusement, then embarrassment, then alarm, as Osler fished discreetly among her clothes, removing a folded square of paper from her skirt waistband, another tucked inside her stocking top, and a third that had been wedged into a T-strap pump. She laid all three on Travis's desk.
"Nobody saw me smuggling these out of Hut 4, sir."
His voice went from weary to cold.
"What do you mean by sneaking decrypted intelligence out of your workplace?"
"Just blank scrap paper."
Osler unfolded each square, demonstrating. She wasn't dim enough to try to illustrate her point here with real cryptograms.
"I am proving to you that it is too blinking easy to get bits of paper out of one's hut. Ever since I went to work as a translator, I've been noticing how simple it would be to smuggle messages out of BP. I thought if I brought it to your attention..."
"There is no one here who would think to misappropriate intelligence, Miss Kendall. Our people are thoroughly vetted."
"I'm not saying it's likely we've got a spy at BP, sir. But if the wrong person here was blackmailed or threatened into obtaining information, they could do it rather easily, depending on where they worked. It's the simplest thing in the world to tuck a slip of paper into your brassiere when everyone's yawning on night shift."
The men shifted at the word brassiere, and Osler nearly rolled her eyes. Point out a security leak and they shrugged, mention a woman's underclothes and everyone got in a wax.
"Obviously, I only know about naval section, but areas like mine would seem the obvious places to tighten up. Where the information goes through the translators and is legible..."
"I don't think we need security advice from a silly dib,"
one of the intelligence men behind Travis said rather nastily.
"You clearly need it from someone," Osler shot back.
"Miss Kendall, I'm sure you meant well, but the matter has been considered. Stick to doing your job," Travis said sternly, "and writing your gossip page fluff."
Osler refused to ask how he knew she wrote Bletchley Blethering's. This was an intelligence facility, after all.
Just because I write gossip page fluff. And what on earth is wrong with fluff if it makes people laugh during a war, for God's sake? It does not mean I have fluff between the ears.
Your concern about our security is noted. But it was very foolish to smuggle anything out of your hut, even blank paper. Go back to your section, and do not pull a trick like this again.
Ozla stamped out, fuming.
In hot water?
Giles greeted her, leaning against one of the stone griffins flanking the mansion's front doors. Yes, and this time I didn't deserve it. What would it take to ever, ever be taken seriously? Ozla knew she was the best translator in her section. She maintained a cracking pace of work and still found time to dash off a weekly chinwag that had the entire park in stitches. She had brought a legitimate potential security problem to the attention of her superiors, yet she was still just a bit of Mayfair crumpet. Why aren't you ever in trouble, Giles? You take so many cigarette breaks, I'm amazed you get anything done at all.
I'm not on break this time.
Giles exhaled a stream of fragrant smoke. He refused to smoke anything but gitans. Who knew what he paid for them on the black market?
My hothead told me to take 20 before he knocked my block off.
Ozla blinked. What about?
I was at the NAAFI kiosk getting some tea and listening to Harry express the rather mild opinion that the Ruskies might be doing a touch better against Operation Barbarossa if we actually shared information with them. Uncle Joe being an ally, after all.
How do you or Harry know we aren't sharing it?
If the Russians saw half the stuff that passes through my heart, they wouldn't be getting stomped quite so thoroughly on the Eastern Front.
Giles offered Ozla a gitan.
Harry got quite hot under the collar about it.
Maybe they aren't properly using the information we give.
No, I suspect the PM is keeping his cards close. Doesn't trust Uncle Joe.
Nothing we can do about that, surely.
That's what I told Harry, but he was on a bit of a rant, and then my hothead said that was commie talk. Harry said you didn't have to be a commie to want to help an ally. I said he had a point, and my hothead told me to take 20 or he'd pound me.
Giles rolled his eyes.
It was Harry's rant, not mine.
Yes, but Harry's enormous. No one's going to threaten to pound him. If I were Harry's size and a man, they'd have taken me seriously in that office.
Ozla took a long drag, still hacked off at that contemptuous silly Deb from the intelligence fellow.
I really cannot stand those MI5 types. She was going to absolutely roast them in the next BB.
It's mutual, I assure you, Giles said airily. Intelligence chaps hate that the information they rely on comes from the kind of people they used to bully at school, namely women, weedy fellows who were better at maths and games, and pansies.
Who here's a pansy? Ozla asked, intrigued.
Angus Wilson, for one. You hear things about touring, too.
Goodness, who knew?
Me, because I'm all-knowing.
You're not all-knowing, you're annoying, Ozla informed him.
Granted, but you love me anyway.
Oh, do I?
Because I don't slaver over you, and girls like you are so used to being slavered over, you'll adore any fellow who just wants to be chums.
Ozla grinned. Aren't you perceptive?
Perceptive enough to know no one else is going to beat Prince Charming. Don't waste any time nailing him down, that's my advice. I dithered about too much and lost the girl of my dreams.
Giles, I never. Who is she? Maybe it's not too late to take a punt at her.
Oh, it's too late. The ink's barely dry on Queen Mab's marriage certificate.
Giles clapped a melodramatic hand to his heart.
I'm soft as a sponge about her, daft as a basket. By the time I was ready to make my move, Mr. Sensitive Bloody War Poet swooped in.
You don't seem too heartbroken, Giles. If I know you, you'll console yourself with a string of wrens. Giles snorted.
Ozla ground out her cigarette, and they parted ways.
I told you Travis would give you a set down, Sally Norton called over when Ozla came back into Hut 4. I'm already missing Deniston, Ozla grumped, squeezing in at the crowded table of translators. The close quarters didn't make it any warmer. They all sat shivering over their stacks of reports, wrapped in scarves and mittens against the hut's arctic chill. Ozla was snuggled inside the huge wool overcoat belonging to her Café de Paris Good Samaritan, Mr. J.P.E.C. Cornwall. Who cared if it was like wearing a circus tent? It was warm. And it still smelled like him, some combination of smoke and heather. She might not know the man's name, but just from wearing his coat, she knew he had excellent taste in cologne and shoulders like Alps. She blew on her hands, steeling herself to pick up the half-translated report, waiting to be finished. A page of idle chatter between German radio operators who should have kept better discipline on air.
but the Y stations transcribed idle chatter as well as official traffic. And these men had been discussing the rumour that Jews were being murdered on the Eastern Front, lined up on the lips of ditches, and shot as the German army advanced.
"It's not verified," Osler told herself. "It's vicious gossip between bored men."
But even in a spotty transcript with missing words, she couldn't miss the lightheartedness, the fact that those radio operators thought it all a great joke. Even if it wasn't true, they thought it was a perfectly decent idea.
"My God, but I wish I was Mab or Beth."
Or at least sometimes Osler did. She wasn't begging off the job she'd worked so hard to get. It was too important. But neither Mab nor Beth spoke German, so they didn't have the burden of understanding whatever information came through their hands on duty. Osler dreamed at night of the things she translated, dreams that inevitably got muddled with the explosion at the Café de Paris. Sometimes she could wake herself before she had to watch Snake Hips Johnson's head be blown off, but more often she was bound inside the memory until the bitter end. Only it didn't end. She just shook and wept in the bloodied rubble, and no one wrapped her in a coat that smelled like smoke and heather, and called her Ozma of Oz.
"Sit down, Ozma, and let me see if you're hurt."
"Who's Ozma of Oz?"
she mused aloud when she met up with Mab and Beth at shift's end.
"What?"
Mab asked, buttoning her coat.
"Never mind. Is that another letter from Francis I see poking out of your pocket, Mrs. Grey?"
They climbed aboard the transport bus. The one disadvantage of their new billet was that it was 8 miles away, no longer a 5-minute stroll from the park. Not that it wasn't worth a daily bus ride just to avoid the dread Mrs. Finch.
"Are you finally getting a proper honeymoon?"
"Francis is taking me to the Lake District.
About bally time. Have you had a single night together these last 2 months since you tied the knot? Not the way our schedules clash. It's just been the odd cafe dinner or tea at a railway station between shifts."
Mab's face didn't exactly soften at the mention of her husband. Queen Mab wasn't the sort to go buttery around the edges. But she gave her wedding band a pleased twirl, and Osler felt a jab she couldn't even pretend wasn't envy. As soon as she got home, she rang London.
"Hello, sailor."
"Hello, princess."
Philip's voice came warmly down the line. He was staying with Lord Mountbatten until the lieutenant's exams. Osler could hear the rustle of paper.
"Burning the midnight oil?"
"Writing a letter, actually."
"Sending love notes to some tart," Osler teased. "I just know you fell into the arms of a hussy or two whenever your ship nipped into port."
"Darling, that's not something a gentleman can talk about."
Which meant, of course, that it had happened. Women had to be good, but not men out to sea halfway around the world. Unfair, but there it was.
"As long as those hussies are on the other side of the world, I can leave them be," Osler decided. "Who's the letter for?"
"Cousin Lilibet. And she's still in the schoolroom, so don't get a case of the green-eyed monster."
"Princess Elizabeth? That cousin?"
His shrug was almost audible.
"She began writing me when she was 13. I send her a line now and then. She's a nice little thing."
Every so often, it struck Osler all over again that her Philip was, in fact, a prince. She knew he was descended from Queen Victoria. She knew he sometimes visited Windsor Castle, and apparently he was posting letters to the future Queen of England, whom he was allowed to call Lilibet. Still, it was difficult to reconcile the prince with the irreverent, tousle-haired naval officer who drove too fast and kissed her senseless.
"What's on your mind, Oz?"
So many things. The frustration of being tossed out of Travis's office without a fair listen. The worry that someone really might smuggle decrypted reports out of BP. Nightmares of the Café de Paris. The horror of hearing that Jews were being murdered in Eastern Europe. If only she could say it aloud. Philip told her so much. His mother, his dreams about Cape Matapan, his sadness at being cut off from his sisters in Germany. What could she tell him? Absolutely nothing. How could you hope to build anything with a man when so many of the things you had to tell him were lies?
"Nothing,"
she answered brightly.
"Just bored to tears out here."
"Better bored than in danger. You have no idea how glad I am you're safe in boring old Bucks."
A pause.
"I love you, you know."
Osler caught her breath. He'd never said that before, not aloud. She hadn't either.
"I love you,"
she whispered back. "So let's make it official, Philip." The words trembled on her tongue. "Run off to the registry office like Mab and Francis. Make a home in hotel rooms whenever you're on leave.
Why not?
Because princes don't marry commoners, Mab would have said. Sometimes Osla thought she was right, that surely there wasn't much future for Philip and herself, even if they had been going together for more than 2 years. At other times, she was inclined to set her jaw and challenge the odds. Philip didn't have a kingdom to rule. He'd made his home in England like Osla. He fought for England like Osla. There was no reason he couldn't please himself, marry whom he chose. It wasn't as if Miss Osla Kendall were a chorus girl dancing on a bar in her garters. She'd been presented to the king and queen. She had funds from her dead father that she'd inherit when she was 30, or when she married, whichever came first. She had a job that mattered, helping save lives, and she was damned good at it. I'm good enough for Philip of Greece, Osla thought defiantly. I'm good enough for anyone.
Are you sure nothing's on your mind, princess?
Flimflam and feathers, darling. You know me.
If there was still a world left by the end of this war, there'd be time to work out what that world held for her and Philip. Today there was only the now, and she wasn't going to waste the now obsessing about what lay ahead.
Want to take this dizzy debutante out dancing?
You're far more than a dizzy deb.
I'm glad someone thinks so.